actually found out about them online. There are so many sites. I mean, one that pops to mind is Dave's ESL Cafe, and they have a fairly comprehensive listing of international schools, or maybe not international schools, but ESL programs around the world in which people can apply and get interviews either online or by phone and then go from there.
Okay, thank you. You've brought some music with you, and so we're going to go to a little bit of that now. As always, if you have any questions for Julie, you can give us a call at 837-2378, and when we come back, we'll go into a little bit more of the details of where Julie's been.
Mm-hmm. welcome back to Going Global with your hosts, Nikki and April, on CFRU. This is a new show that features interviews with graduate students who've lived, worked, or traveled abroad. And we're here in the studio with Julie today. Could you tell us a little bit about music in China these days, Julie?
Well, as you can probably decipher, the piece we just played was a classical piece, very mellow. But what's interesting is this is really making a comeback because post-cultural revolution, a lot of the classical music had died down a little bit. And in current days, the classical pieces and the instruments are really gaining popularity. Like this CD in particular was a gift from one of my high school students, and it's something they would even listen to. So it's quite interesting to see the popularity of classical music even among youth in China.
That's interesting. I wouldn't have expected that. So I'm wondering if you could tell us a little bit about the curriculum that you used when you were teaching in these three locations. Did you have a set curriculum that you followed, or were you able to have some flexibility with that?
Well, interestingly enough, when I first went to Abu Dhabi, they didn't have a curriculum in place. So upon my arrival, they said, okay, put together a curriculum for your second grade year. Thought, wow. So that in 2 days, I managed to outline. I used mainly American textbooks, and that would serve to infuse the curriculum with which I would teach the students. So it was. I tried to draw on a lot of the experiences from my education background. So trying to use different learning styles in my teaching strategies, different assessment styles, just trying to gain access to all the different learning styles that the students would have. In China, my first year in Jinhua, because it was with a Canadian school and under review of the Ministry of Ontario of Education, we did follow the guidelines as set by the Ministry of Education. And so using their curriculum documents, I then, you know, formulated a study with which we could target all the objectives set by the Ontario government.
I wonder if we can focus in a little bit on your first experience in Abu Dhabi. If you could tell us a little bit about the place, the location itself.
Sure. Well, Abu Dhabi is the capital city of the United Arab Emirates, more or less the political center of things. Dubai is a lot more recognized internationally. Known as the shopping mall of the world. But Abu Dhabi was really interesting. It's right nestled in on the Persian Gulf, and the Emirati have really, I mean, the wealth in that nation is really quite incredible. And they have gone over the period of 30 years from really a nomadic Bedouin community into this modern metropolitan society, and where two-thirds of their workforce are expats. So all the teachers in Abu Dhabi or the UAE as a whole come from other countries, the medical profession, other countries, the labor force, taxi drivers, restaurant servers, mall tenants, they all come from other countries. And so the student body is a lot more than Emiratis. You have the children of all these expats. So my classroom, for example, was mainly Palestinian, Lebanese, and some Jordanian, as well as Yemenis. So it was a mix of the Arab world. And so the dynamics were really quite interesting. And I had to really draw on some of the notions of multicultural education and reaching all these sort of diverse groups of students.
And what did you find there was the social situation of the parents of your students? What kind of work did they do, and how well were they accepted in the country?
Well, it's the UAE is quite interesting. The Arabs who work there from other countries are pretty well accepted, but they still are segregated into their own groups. So like the Egyptians usually hang out with Egyptians, the Lebanese hang out with the Lebanese, and so forth. And I saw those dynamics at play in my classroom as well. Sometimes things would get tense, you know, maybe the Palestinian kids would beat up on the Egyptian kids or whatnot. So I found that peacekeeping duties entered the realm of my classroom quite often. But in terms of what the parents did, there was such a variety from engineers to government policymakers to they were all rather wealthy, I must say, though, because it was a private school. And so the kids were used to being rather catered to at home. For instance, I can recall on my first day of class, one of my girls saying, my pencil fell on the floor. And, you know, my response was, okay, we'll pick it up. But my maid's not here. I never pick things up for myself. So these elements kind of infused my discipline strategy in the classroom, in which self-sufficiency was a whole new term to them. But it was interesting. It was quite good.
Why did you decide to teach there?
I've always been really fascinated by the Middle East. I've traveled through there in the past, like on my way to Africa and back, and I really enjoy the culture. I find it fascinating. Like, every day is just so alive and full of sounds and energy, and there is never a boring moment, and you never know what you're going to get every time you step out of your house. And it is really a multicultural society because, as I said, two-thirds of their workforce are international expats. So within my building, my neighbors were Egyptian, they were American, they were Indian, Sri Lankan, Filipino. I mean, it was just such a multicultural setting that it really is quite energetic.
So you said that most of the other teachers there were international teachers. Where were other people from, and what was their experience like working there?
Well, there were a few Canadians. Two of my roommates were Canadian. We had this amazing apartment where my bedroom overlooked the Persian Gulf and this crystal blue water I would wake up to every morning, and my weekends were spent on the beach. So there were some Canadians, a lot of British, actually, the British expats. They had a strong community there. Americans were there to a certain extent. We had quite a few Indian staff, as well as some Lebanese and Palestinian teachers were what made up the bulk of our school environment. I know they had some actual schools that were either the American community school or the British community school, so those would cater to more that expat community, but ours was sort of a mix of various nationalities.
And you mentioned that with that mix of various nationalities, sometimes there was cultural clashes. Were you ever able to achieve a balance in your classroom and sort of impart to the kids the need to have, you know, cultural understanding, or was it just an ongoing challenge?
I would say it was, at first, I would say the first 3 months, that tension was definitely obvious. Over the course of the year, and I think also seeing me interact with people of various cultures, the difference, I think, with the people who go to teach overseas, you have a group of people who like to associate with their own culture. So you might have some Canadians who go over and all their friends are Canadians. Whereas another group, and this is the group I tend to fall into, when I go overseas, I like to integrate into local culture. I like to mix with various other people, learn about their lives and whatnot. And so I think my students, in seeing me befriending all the other Arab teachers, I think perhaps that kind of infused their own, like, fellowship among their peers. And so by the end of the year, I can honestly say, like, I would attend some of my students' birthday parties, which was really big, you know, teacher, teacher, come to my house, which was always interesting to walk into these huge mansions. By the end of the year, like, most of the class would be invited to these students' birthday parties. So it was really kind of promising to see that evolve throughout the year.
Were there any other major challenges that you faced, or was that sort of the major one?
You know, I tend to be really, I go with the flow. I've had a fair amount of experience overseas, so I can say that I don't get really shocked by too many things. I know that it can be really challenging for some people. If I had any advice to give to people going overseas, would be to leave all your North American expectations back home in Canada, because things really don't work the way you anticipate them to work. Expectations have no room in the overseas experience. And so, but this still doesn't, for people who are going for the first time, it can be really challenging. Like, we lost 3 teachers within the first month of school in Abu Dhabi because, I guess, just the cultural shock of things was a little too much for them, and they would, you know, take off and not show up for class the next day. And then you'll later find out they had a plane ticket home back to wherever. But as for myself, I really, I mean, like, just the food, the energy, the I loved experiencing Ramadan in a Muslim country. It was really interesting. I enjoyed going to my friends' homes in which they would prepare these elaborate Arabic dishes. We'd listen and dance to Arabic music, and it was fun. I really enjoyed it.
Did you notice if the parents took any notice of the kids getting along more in class, or how do you think the parents saw the classroom experience and having all these expat teachers having so much influence on their children?
It's interesting. I had very little connection with the parents. The only time I really did, this is a big difference between China and Abu Dhabi. The parents, I practically had to like pull them in for teacher-parent interviews, and oftentimes there was that language barrier, so their child served as interpreter between me and the parent. So it was really hard to gauge what they were thinking. And then also, of course, some of the mothers who would be coming in would be fully veiled, so I actually didn't ever see anything on their face. So, you know, whereas in North America, a lot of body language factors into our interpretation of what a person feels, I didn't get that connection with them. So that I can't really say I was able to fully assess what the parents felt. I did get to the birthday parties I did attend. It was interesting to see the parents talking to the parents of other children from other nationalities. So that was really neat to see. Other than that, I can't really say I was able to assess that too much.
You mentioned that some of the women who came in were fully veiled. Did you find any challenges in being a non-Muslim woman in that culture?
Most certainly. Yeah, definitely. I took these challenges with a grain of salt, though, mind you, because I knew what to expect going to a Muslim country. I would say, being a woman, especially as you went into the higher grades, some of my fellow teachers who taught in boys' classes, they didn't necessarily get a ton of respect, whereas their fellow male counterparts would. So that was at play. I certainly had some comments like, what is an unmarried white woman doing here? Things like that, which were, you know, kind of interesting. Or students that would come up to me and say, Miss Julie, why aren't you married? My mom wants to know. Do you want to come meet my brother? He's 25. Like my little six-year-old students trying to set me up with their older brothers. But things like that, which was kind of fun. But overall, like, I mean, in the school community, it was fine. I mean, I dressed modestly. I respected the law of the land, so to speak. I mean, that's what you have to do. Obviously, you guys know that, too, going overseas. Some of the things that were kind of interesting were the comments that some of my students made with regards to me being non-Muslim. Some of them were saying that they didn't want me to go to hell because I was Christian, or, you know, they assumed I was Christian, which I wasn't. But so things like that factored in, and you kind of knew that some elements of their what was going on at home was fueling their comments in the class.
Great. That's very interesting. Thank you for sharing your experiences with us. We're going to go to another song now. And when we come back, we'll talk to you about your experiences teaching in China. And our phone number here at the studio is 837-2378 if you'd like to call in with any questions.
Oh, 下的真理，我始终无法参透这个道理。三般若波罗蜜多是造者五蕴皆空，度一切苦厄舍利子，色不异空，空不异色，色即是空，空即是受想行识亦复如是，舍利子是诸法空相，不生不灭，不垢不净，不增不减，是故空中无色，无所想行识，无眼耳鼻舌身意，无色声香味触法，无眼界，乃至无欲世界，无明亦无明尽，乃至无老死亦无老死尽，无不净灭道，不是亦无得。
Welcome back to Going Global. We're here with Julie Desrochers, who's talking about her experiences teaching overseas. As always, if you have any questions, you can give us a call at 837-2378. Julie, can you tell us a little bit about the music that we just heard?
Yeah, we just listened to a young R&B / rap singer from China. His name is Jay Cho. Quite popular among the youth, and again, a gift from one of my students. Very popular among the females in the class. He also has done a few North American tours and has gained popularity in North America beyond the Chinese frontier.
Could we switch gears and talk a little bit now about the school in China where you taught? Can you tell us about who you were teaching, how many you had in your class?
Sure. Well, the school I went to was through the Canadian Trillium College, which is based in Toronto. They are a private school, and they're more or less, prior to them actually setting up satellite schools in China, they served as a bridge for Chinese students entering mainstream education in Canada. They usually went from a high school in China, did 1 year of doing, at the time, OACs, and then entered university via that route. So because of the popularity of the school in Toronto, they decided, the administration of the Canadian Trillium College decided to set up some satellite schools in various locales in China where Canadian teachers would, in partnership with the Chinese schools, give courses, Ontario-based courses, to Chinese students who were eventually hoping to end up in Canadian or foreign universities. So in the first year, the year I went was their first year in Jinhua City. And this is in Zhejiang Province, which is in West China, just as I mentioned, south of Shanghai. And so the only courses we were offering were the basic ESL-CO, ESL-BO classes that would be the same courses that new immigrants to Canada would take before getting into mainstream curriculum in Ontario. So they would be earning Ontario credits through taking my courses, and we did have inspections from a Ministry of Education, and we had to follow all the guidelines as set by the ministry. Again, it was only for qualified teachers. And what I had was I had two classes, but I would teach them throughout the day. So I was pretty well teaching 6 hours a day, and those were spent, they could have been at 8 in the morning or 8:30 p.m. The way the Chinese school is set up is and it was a boarding school, so they were pretty much in class till 9:30 every day and up at 6 o'clock doing their morning exercises. And I also lived on campus and was in charge of a group of girls, so I was kind of like what we would kind of connote as the house mom. And some of these children who were in my class, they were mainly 16, 17 years old. So they were taking both the Chinese curriculum and my courses in tandem. So they had a lot of work, but they rarely saw their parents. They came from very affluent families, again, because it was a private school. And some of these, like one boy, I think, saw his parents once a year. And so due to their absence, the teachers really took on a parental role towards these kids. And so I found my involvement really extended past the classroom. And I mean, I'd be counseling kids at, 11 o'clock at night who were having some kind of emotional breakdown or just wanted to talk about some issue that was happening in their life. And it was interesting. It was definitely intense. I've never worked so hard in my life, and felt like I had very little time off because school basically started at 5 in the afternoon on Sunday and finished at 12 noon on Saturday. So you had a little window, and as I said, I mean, my classes started at 8:30, might have had a couple hours of break in the afternoon, and usually finished at 9 o'clock at night. So it was definitely a very laborious process, but it definitely was one of the best experiences of my life as well. I became very close with my students.
And why did you decide to teach in this school?
Well, I had a friend who had participated in one of the other satellite schools, and the incentives went far beyond the teaching experience. Like, I was also in charge of promoting the school in the community, so this included doing radio talk shows like this one, where I'd have an interpreter, obviously, reaching the newspaper interviews, television interviews, so I became somewhat of a minor celebrity in Jinhua, I have to say. I had people come up to me and ask me for my autograph on the street, because at this point, and the thing with China is it is rapidly changing. The year I went, this is a city of about 1 million people. The year I went, there were about 3 foreigners. By the end of the year, there was probably 25 foreigners in the city. So at the initial start of that year, the community was not that exposed to foreigners, so I was really a novelty in the city. And I mean, I could walk into stores and everyone would stop what they were doing and just congregate around me and watch everything I did with great intensity. So, and they would, if I went into a supermarket and I started buying food, a woman would actually follow me and purchase everything I was purchasing. So it was quite incredible. Like, I really felt conscious of what I was doing because I want to somewhat portray a good role model for these people who are obviously taking quite a intent interest in what I was doing. But it was quite an experience.
It seems like under those circumstances, it might be difficult to feel like you had your own space, your own privacy, some of the things that we really value here. How did you deal with that?
No space, no privacy. This is very true. So when they have their break in January, obviously they don't have Christmas, so I worked through Christmas, worked through New Year, which is fine. I mean, that's part of the international experience. But come our break, we had 2 weeks off at the end of January. I flew to Hong Kong, and I just totally went crazy. I ate foreign food. I just went to movies. I had this air of anonymity, which was exactly what I needed. Because I have to admit, by the end of January, I was going a bit batty just with I felt like I was under a microscope at all times. Again, it's not for everyone. The teachers who replaced me, they left after a month. Like, I only stayed at the school for 1 year. The teacher who replaced me left. His replacement teacher left. And then finally, they did get someone to stay. But it's a very intense experience. And I think this is something that people should really be aware of before they go overseas, is they really need to know what they're getting into. I mean, some experiences, like my experience in Shanghai, there are so many foreigners in Shanghai, people hardly pay any attention to you. But if you're going to a smaller community, as Jinhua was, you have to be wary of the fact that you're going to get a lot of attention.
You mentioned that sort of some of the challenges were related to you being a foreigner and not having any privacy or personal space. Were there any challenges related to the fact of just being in a communist country?
That's really interesting. The challenges are very city-specific or region-specific. In a city like Shanghai, Beijing, you would not even recognize that you were in a communist country. In a city like Jinhua, where there was a really strong communist root, I mean, Chairman Mao had one of his first meetings but 100 kilometers away, so there's a real tradition of embracing communism. There are still a lot of tight control regulation mechanisms at play. For instance, as I mentioned, I did live on campus. They did monitor every phone call I made, every phone call that came in, who visited me, at what times. Like, there was an actual ongoing log that chronicled my activities. I also, as I said, I like to really intermingle with the culture. So most of my friends were Chinese, and we used to, because I used to work at 9, get together 9:30, 10 o'clock, and just hang out, watch movies or whatever. And there is a rule in some of these sort of more communist regions where groups of 6 or more, I think is the rule, are not allowed to congregate unless under special permission, because the fear is they might be forming a league that could be somewhat subversive. So these colleagues of mine, these friends of mine, were then told or warned that they couldn't meet with me anymore in large groups. I could still meet with them on a basis of 2-3 at a time, but the group of 6 of us were no longer permitted to meet together because it was breaking these rules of associating beyond 6 in a group. So those were kind of interesting, I have to say.
Now, how do they monitor that type of thing? How do they monitor the groups and the phone calls?
People are always watching you. As I said, you cannot escape the lens that is always on you, especially as a tall, I mean, I'm 6'1". I draw a lot of attention no matter where I go. And so it's so funny because when I did return to Jinhua 6 months after I left, I went to visit some friends. People I didn't even know, like shopkeepers, would come out of their store and say, "Hi, Julie, nice to see you again." So the fact was, people knew who I was. They knew about me, they knew my name, even if I didn't know them. I was definitely a feature in the community. So it's hard not to escape that attention.
So the other students who were teaching there, were they Chinese, and were they subject to the same issues?
Oh, yeah. It was an all-Chinese school, so all my students were Chinese. And as I said, they were from more of the affluent Chinese families, which is definitely something interesting. You mentioned communism. There's definitely an emerging gap between haves and have-nots in China, which kind of negates what our concept of communism is. There's a lot of factors that don't at all play into the socialist aspect. I mean, they still have to pay for their health care, they still have to pay for their education. So what we consider communism is not necessarily their working definition of communism. But my students were all Chinese, as I said, 16, 17-year-old. Most of them had experience overseas. So we were dealing with a whole different group of kids than you would encounter in, let's say, rural China, who would have very little experience with the world outside their communities.
Okay, we're going to go to another song, and then when we come back, we're going to talk with Julie about her experience teaching ESL.
and welcome back to Going Global. As always, if you have any questions, feel free to give us a call at 837-2378. Julie, can you tell us a little bit about the music we just heard?
Sure. This was a classical instrument called the arhu. It's a two-stringed fiddle, although sometimes I think it might be three, but it's one of the most popular Chinese instruments in the Hu Qin family, and Hu here stands for foreign. It's also making quite a comeback. You see a lot of young students taking up the arhu as part of their musical lessons, like students here in Canada might take piano lessons.
Okay. And so we were previously just talking to you about your experience at one school in China, but you actually taught at a second school. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah. I wasn't intending to stay in China. I had a bad case of pneumonia following my last experience, which went on for about 3 months. So upon wrapping up my contract, I headed back to Canada to cure myself, remedy myself of this pneumonia, which was not being treated properly in China, which took another 2 months upon arriving in Canada. So I had pneumonia for 5 months. And so my intention wasn't really to go back to China, but I found it quite difficult to find work in Canada. I came back also to apply to master's degree, get all that wrapped up. But upon not securing employment, I decided after my sister's wedding, which happened to be in Mexico, after coming back from Mexico a week later, I was back on a plane over to Shanghai this time, in which I got a job, as I mentioned, through a website to work in a primary school teaching ESL. Very, very, very challenging experience. There was chaos abounded in this school, and 41 six-year-olds and myself in a tiny little classroom with no assistants. And they didn't speak a word of English. They knew maybe how to say hi, good morning, things like this. So the experience here was so different than my prior experiences. And I also don't have much ESL experience because the students I have taught overseas spoke English coming to me. So the challenge of dealing with a whole new batch of 41 kids and the language barrier definitely made this experience quite unique.
So what were some of the things that you did to cope with this experience? How did you deal with all of these children?
I learned a few key Chinese phrases like sit down, be quiet, listen to the teacher. And just really, I had to be extremely creative. And also, again, my training is in teaching high school students. So I really did a lot of reading on the internet about how to gauge young learners and included games and interaction. And I mean, the curriculum which they supplied was pathetic. I mean, going from hi and good morning to I like pink. You look nice in pink. This color really suits you. I mean, bridging that gap was insane. But nonetheless, I did my best and ran with it.
Can you tell us a little bit about your first couple days there? I imagine, you know, you walk into this classroom, there's 41 six-year-olds and you don't speak a common language. How did you even begin?
Well, let's put it this way. I got off a plane at about 11 o'clock at night without my luggage, which was still apparently in San Francisco somewhere. Had to start teaching the next morning. And so being jet-lagged, wearing the same clothes I arrived in after a 12-hour flight, and then encountering these dynamics. And part of the contract, this is the thing, my two former experiences were very legit. They were through international organizations, and so everything that was promised me in the contract ended up being fulfilled. Whereas with some of these, and again, a little warning to people who might be considering going overseas, do your research, because some of these organizations that do advertise on the websites might not be completely what you expect in terms of legitimacy. So part of my contract was to have an assistant teacher with me at all times, someone who spoke the language and who could help with classroom management, discipline issues. This person never appeared in the entire duration of my contract. So the first day was literally chaos. I had kids jumping up, you know, coming to touch my cheeks, you know, pulling my hair. They just were all over me. They were just so enthusiastic. I mean, they were little angels, but at the same time just went nuts over having this white person in their classroom. And, of course, at the time I had long blonde hair, and so they just were the girls went nuts. I was like their own little private Barbie doll, life size. But it was interesting. Finally, though, by the end of my stay, I don't know how I managed it. It was a process, I suppose. But I would have Chinese teachers calling me into their classrooms to get their kids under control. So there was a definite switch over in what you would expect.
Besides the discipline problems and some of the conditions that you just described, are there any other differences that come to mind between the Canadian school that you had previously taught at and this school?
Definitely. In the Canadian school, I was using a lot of the techniques that are more or less Canadian specific, you know, self-directed learning, group learning, just problem-based situations, a lot more along what I would use in an ordinary Canadian classroom. Whereas in Shanghai, A, we didn't have the resources for that. B, we didn't have the space for that. With 41 young kids, you just don't start doing group learning activities. They're just, philosophically, they aren't ready and able to do that. They wouldn't know what to do. So I definitely had to take a lot more of an authoritarian way of approach to teaching in the Shanghai experience, just because the students didn't respond to anything else. I didn't like having to be stern and forceful, but I really found there was no other way.
You face a lot of challenges with this, obviously. What were some of the most rewarding parts of the job?
Oh, the kids who cried when I left because they just fell in love with me and I fell in love with them. And when they would see me walking down the street, because obviously I was living close to the school, so we were living in the same community within Shanghai, they would just start jumping up and pulling their parents to come see me. And they were just, this is one of the difference between, I would say, Abu Dhabi and China as a whole. The parents really involved me in their lives. I was frequently invited over for dinners. They would take me out on weekend excursions. It was just thorough involvement within my life and their life. So it was really quite positive in the relationships that formed between the teachers and the parents.
So reflecting on all three teaching experiences that you had, overall, what do you recommend for people to prepare themselves for these kind of experiences?
Do your research. I didn't do enough research going into Shanghai, which I should have known better because I have had experience overseas, but my two prior experiences were so positive and so just, I mean, working within certain Canadian expectations of job, you know, integrity and owning up to terms of a contract. But if I would recommend, if you are going through a website sort of job application forum, ask to talk to some teachers who are working with that company already. You know, call them, email them, whatever. Gauge, get a sense of what they feel about the organization. Make sure that they pay on time. Make sure that they own up to the terms of their contract. So I think a lot of the prep work, I think it is about prep work, making sure you know what you're getting into.
Okay, we're going to go to one more song and then come back and talk to Julie a little bit more about her advice for those interested in going overseas and what she's currently doing. As always, if you have any questions, you can give us a call at 837-2378. Welcome back to Going Global. We're here with Julie, who's just been telling us a little bit about her experience teaching overseas. I know you're saying, you know, your advice for people would be to really check into what they're getting into before they go overseas. Is there any other advice you'd give for while they're overseas?
Give themselves room to have ups and downs. You're going to have ups, you're going to have downs. That's part of the overseas adventure. I would say have contact with your friends back home, because even your best intentions of going local, becoming a local, you still have these cravings for Canadian culture and content. So stay in touch with friends back home. And if, you know, even if you're, all your friends are Chinese or wherever you end up being, I think you still need some outlets. You need some time on your own and space to kind of just decompress and absorb things and let yourself just be.
And how do you think these experiences sort of overall changed you as a person?
Well, one of the benefits of being overseas is your traveling is so accessible. I mean, in Abu Dhabi, for example, you're 4 hours from Africa, you're 4 hours from India, you're 4 hours from Europe, so everything is within range, and the price is right, so you do end up doing a lot of traveling. And this, I think, really fostered my desire to work internationally, but not just in teaching, but in development practice. And so I was able to interact with other people who were working overseas in the capacity of working for an NGO. And as such, I decided, well, yeah, this is what I want to do. And it shaped the avenue and entry into my master's degree, which I'm now doing in Royal Extension.
What do you think about the impact that you had on your students? What do you think they most learned from you?
Well, I know for my the high school students at the second school, we're still in touch, and so I get emails from them, you know, wishing me Happy Teacher's Day or things like that, and they always want to know about what I'm doing, and so I stay in touch with them. And so I think a lot of them felt really that they weren't capable of coming overseas to study in a Canadian school. And I think I helped them develop a confidence and skill level that allowed them to believe in themselves. This is one of the things that the take-home messages I really want to drive home was giving them the confidence, self-esteem, and allowing them to make decisions for themselves. As for the kids in Abu Dhabi, I'd like to think that I did play a role in increasing their fellowship among themselves, and it was fun to see that evolve. So I'd say those were the two key things that I...
Is there anything that you would have changed about any of these experiences? What would that be?
Well, I would say my first experience, not at all. I really thoroughly enjoyed them and gained so much from it. The third experience in Shanghai, As I said, I had a few issues with them not owing up to the terms of the contract. And so I would probably have done a lot more research going into that.
Okay, thank you so much for your time today. It was great to have you here. And as always, you can tune in next week from 12 to 1 when we'll be back with another guest talking about more international research.
Ed Video Media Arts Center is thrilled to celebrate Queer Identities Week with Flesh of the Word, a fascinating film program curated by Guelph resident Robert Brandstetter. This series of videos explores both the role of language in defining sexual identities, as well as the consequences of the word for people whose identities are marginalized and maligned through traditional language systems, be they scientific, medical, or psychiatric. In some cases, the consequences of marginalizing someone identified, say, as queer, transgendered, or prostitute, produces a spectrum of results from stigmatized silence to socially accepted violence. These films and videos try to address these issues for the artists involved, and Ed Video is pleased to offer this program as part of events commemorating Queer Identities Week in Guelph. Ed Video Media Arts Center presents Flesh of the Word on Friday, October 28, 2005, at 8 p.m. at 16A Wyndham Street North in Guelph. General admission is $5, and EVMAC members are permitted for free. For more information, please visit edvideo.org or call 519-836-9811.
This is the BBC World Service with Jo Fujin at 17 hours GMT. The American Secretary of State has said she's deeply troubled by the conclusions of a United Nations report that alleges Syrian involvement in the assassination of the former Lebanese Prime Minister Rafiq Hariri. The American ambassador at the UN spelled out what the findings meant.
It refers to lack of cooperation by Syria, which is diplo-speak for obstruction of justice. It's a very hard-hitting report.
We'll examine the evidence and discuss Washington's options for possible action. The Iraqi government has condemned the killing of a lawyer acting for one of Saddam Hussein's co-defendants. and a close political ally of President Bush has appeared in court on money laundering charges. Over the next half hour, we'll hear reports and analysis from the BBC's worldwide network of correspondents on these and the rest of today's main stories. And we'll begin with a news bulletin.
BBC News with Lucy Wesley. The American Secretary of State, Condoleezza Rice, has called for accountability from Syria after the publication of a United Nations report which implicates Syrians in the assassination of the former Lebanese Prime Minister, Rafik Hariri. Dr. Rice said the findings of the UN report were deeply troubling. She declined to say what the US government would do about it, but said the UN Security Council would be the focal point for any action. Our State Department correspondent Jonathan Beale reports.
The publication of the Mellis report has only confirmed US suspicions that Syria was behind the murder of Rafik Hariri. Condoleezza Rice said the implication of the UN investigation was that Syrian officials were involved in the assassination.